From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. Midnight is come and gone. Is there a deal or a lockout? A deadline or a deadline extension? A handshake or a spate of lawsuits? Just what is going on in the NFL collective bargaining sessions? That's coming up on Only a Game. Also, a consideration of what might happen if the NBA's CBA expires, and a conversation with Rob Ruck, the author of Raceball. Also ahead, why February is the month for beach volleyball in the gleaming sands of New Hampshire.
It's not chilly, it's a little rocky, but it's not bad for New Hampshire. You know, you expect it, it's the Granite State. There's got to be some stuff in the sand.
There's some granite in there.
Stay tuned.
Major funding for Only a Game comes from Oliver Wyman, an international strategy consulting firm. With 3,000 professionals worldwide, Oliver Wyman serves global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com.
This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. The National Football League and the NFL Players Association continue to operate in a way that would have driven Cinderella nuts. On the deadline front, in their negotiations, midnight Thursday night turned into midnight Friday night, and late yesterday afternoon, that became midnight next Friday. For football fans, the good news is that the two sides have not yet allowed the clock to strike 12. They've provided themselves with additional time to reach an agreement that would avoid a lockout, a development that might delay the start of the 2011 NFL season or even put the whole campaign in jeopardy. The bad news is that there is still no agreement. According to Gary Roberts, dean of the Indiana University Law School at Indianapolis, that's partly because the principal representatives of the two sides, NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell and Players Association head Demoris Smith, have each promised a good deal to their constituencies.
Goodell promised that he was going to take back all of the concessions that Paul Tagliabue gave in 2006, and Demoris Smith promised his players and agents that he was going to hold on and not give anything back, and so they sort of painted themselves into a political corner and can't really make major compromises or concessions this early in the game, which is why I think we're sort of at loggerheads and why I've predicted you're not going to see a deal done until August or September.
The personalities come and go in negotiations of this sort. A lot of the issues remain the same. Here's one most people familiar with collective bargaining will recognize right away. Money. The NFL generates about $9 billion a year. The owners currently get to swallow the first billion before they have to start giving money to the players. These owners want the second billion as well. The players would prefer not to lose a share of that second billion, which, according to Vermont Law School sports law professor Michael McCann, is not quite to suggest that there are no other matters for debate.
For instance, whether or not there should be an 18-game season. There's the player conduct policy that Commissioner Goodell of the NFL has. But the key issue is money and how much of a pay cut, as the players look at it, should players take in order for the NFL to continue. The owners, though, insist that given the economic circumstances and given that up to 90% of revenue is shared among the teams, that concessions have to be made.
The failure of the two sides to reach an agreement has inevitably led to charges of recalcitrance from both camps. Professor James Gross of Cornell Law School feels that recent developments in the bargaining cast doubt on those charges.
It's clear that hard bargaining is going on, but I don't see any evidence that the owners are trying to bust the union or deny them their collective bargaining rights. I think the fact that you have further extensions indicates that there's some good faith involved here, but I don't see any evidence of denying them or seeking to bust the union.
Since the negotiations are occurring while organized labor and the right to bargain collectively are under attack in Wisconsin and elsewhere, some observers have lumped the struggle of the NFL players with the struggles of teachers, state and municipal employees, and various other workers trying to assert their traditional rights. James Gross feels that's inappropriate and inaccurate.
What's going on in Wisconsin and those states talking about denying people their right to engage in collective bargaining, what I consider to be a human right, the NFL negotiations pale in comparison.
Which is not to suggest that those negotiations are not significant. Pro football is not only a $9 billion a year business that employs tens of thousands of people to do the hundreds of tasks required to produce games. It is also the country's most popular sport. Those who depend on the game for their livelihoods and those who just enjoy watching it each weekend and, who knows, perhaps even betting on it, certainly hope that the tone of next week's second extension of the bargaining period will be more productive. Professor Michael McCann, for one, feels that's likely.
I think there's a shot. I think some of the rhetoric will be toned down. I think there's now a recognition that they're getting to the point where if neither side blinks, then they're both worse off. When push comes to shove, there's going to be a strong impetus on both ends to get a deal done, even if neither are really happy about it.
The alternatives to that outcome are nasty to contemplate. If the players' union concludes that the NFL is not bargaining in good faith, the players could elect to decertify their own union, which, according to Professor McCann, would inevitably invite the courts into the ongoing misadventure.
Decertification would mean that the National Football League Players Association no longer represents NFL players as a collective unit. And as a result, rules that have been collectively bargained between the Players Association and the league would lose what's called the labor exemption. And without the labor exemption, many NFL rules, including the salary cap, would become subject to antitrust law. So it's a pretty substantial move on the part of the players.
The owners can probably avoid that substantial move and the unpredictable legal wrangling it would provoke by scaling back their demands regarding that second $1 billion mentioned earlier. But those dollars aren't the only thing on the minds of the players, at least according to Izell Reese, who retired from the NFL in 2004. Reese feels the two additional regular season games the owners want would take a significant toll on the health of the players, and on matters like that, he is an expert.
I had neck surgery. I have nerve damage in my left shoulders. I can't tell you how many concussions and how many fingers I've dislocated over the years, but I won't really feel the effects of that until I get older, until I'm 36 now, until I'm 46, 56. But yet my health benefits have deceased after that first 5 years upon my retirement.
Unless the current negotiations improve upon that benefit, today's players, like Izell Reese, may be on the hook for whatever medical expenses they incur after they've been out of the NFL for 5 years, even if those expenses come as a direct result of their previous employment. Izell Reese and lots of other current and former players, folks employed by the NFL and the teams, and millions of fans will be watching this week to see if the league and the Players Association can take advantage of that second overtime in bargaining. The NFL's labor issues have been getting most of the attention, but within a matter of months, the NBA may also face a suspension of activity. For months, Billy Hunter, the director of the union representing the NBA players, has been saying that he is, quote, 99% certain that his organization will not reach a new collective bargaining agreement with the owners, who have proposed ambitious changes in their relationship with their employees. The current agreement expires on June 30th. Joining me now to discuss the possibility that the current NBA season is the last one we'll see for a while is Howard Beck of the New York Times. Howard, welcome to Only a Game.
Hi, thanks for having me.
The owners and Commissioner Stern maintain that the league cannot continue to operate under the present circumstances because 17 of the 30 teams are losing money and the league is allegedly losing $300 million a year. What are the most significant changes the owners want to make?
They're looking for a so-called hard cap to replace the current soft cap. The soft cap means that you can go beyond the cap in certain circumstances, and most teams do. Hard cap means there's no going beyond it, which is what the NFL has. They also want to roll back salaries, which really is unprecedented in this league, but not in the NHL, which had this a few years ago when they had their lockout. So they want to roll back salaries by about 38% to 40%. Obviously, a fairly large number. It represents, I believe, about $800 million. They want to reduce the amount that contracts can be guaranteed and make them only partially guaranteed. They want to shorten the number of years on a contract. So it's just a lot of things that basically, you know, take back privileges or perks that the players have had for a long time and obviously reduces quite a bit the total amount of salary that would be doled out to the players in any given NBA season.
The players' position seems to be that the current agreement is working pretty well, although they've offered some concessions. Are they being unrealistic, do you think?
It's hard to say. The players, yes, they believe that the system that is in place now works perfectly fine. They look out and they see good attendance and high TV ratings and incredible popularity with the league right now, and it certainly is. And the quality of basketball is at a high, the number of star players, exciting players. So there are a lot of things that the union can point to and say, look, the league is perfectly healthy, but the league will come back every time and say, yes, all those things are true, but the bottom line is what it is. Costs have gone up on a number of fronts, including player salaries, and they feel like they're at a breaking point.
Have negotiations between the NFL and the league's players had any impact on what's gone on, or rather what hasn't gone on with regard to the NBA?
I think indirectly, but not directly. You know, all these things will have, if not played out, they'll be far down the line, and the NBA could possibly take some cues. The two leagues also borrow from each other quite a bit in terms of the types of things that end up in these labor deals. You know, the NBA adopted its salary cap in 1984. The NFL adopted one in 95, 11 years later. The NBA has a rookie scale that's been around since, I believe, 94, 95 or so. And the NFL has been trying to go that route. So there are different things, elements of these labor deals that get borrowed or, you know, back and forth that these guys take cues from each other.
The two sides still have 4 months to reach a new agreement. Which side, if either, is likely to feel more pressure to do that as time goes by?
Well, the conventional thinking is that it's usually the players. You know, the owners have more money. that's kind of the nature of the beast. So the argument the NBA always makes is some of these owners, it will be more profitable for them to not have a season than to have a season because they're operating at a loss anyway. So if you take that and then you take the fact that the NBA players, though they have an average salary of $5 million, you know, there's, you know, expenses for them just like anybody else. And, you know, as I think it was Patrick Ewing said during the last lockout of 99, we make a lot of money, but we spend a lot of money. Well, if they continue that way, it makes it very difficult for them to get through several months of a lockout when the paychecks stop coming.
In the past, when pro baseball or football or basketball or hockey seasons have been delayed or interrupted, fans have always come back once labor and management have gotten an agreement, although it has sometimes taken a while. Would it be different if both the National Football League and the NBA were shut down at the same time?
It would really be incredible to see that happen, obviously incredible in a bad way. For people's livelihoods and also for the fans who watch and love these sports. And by the way, the NHL and Major League Baseball are also going to have their CBAs coming up soon. But the idea of the NFL and the NBA both being shut down at the same time, it's you know, mind-blowing to even consider. And I think for sports fans, or a lot of them, it would probably be pretty depressing.
Howard Beck writes about the NBA for the New York Times. Howard, thank you very much for speaking with me.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
I feel a little sentimental shame. Where's the hungry man gonna live at in this town? Oh, they're tearing the labor camps down.
It's 19 minutes past the hour. There are many reasons to celebrate the play with which Danielle Clawson led her Concordia College basketball team to victory on Monday. Clawson, who had the ball out of bounds under her own basket with 0.7 seconds remaining in the tie game against College of Idaho, bounced the ball off the back of a defending player, then stepped in bounds, recovered the ball, and popped in a layup as the buzzer sounded. Concordia 63, College of Idaho 61. So huzzah for the heads-up play, certainly, and hooray for the poise with which Clawson sunk the layup as time ran out, and a third and perhaps loudest cheer for her response after the game when she was asked how she'd thought of the play. "It's something my dad taught me," Danielle Clawson said.
Out of bounds.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, a conversation with Rob Ruck, author of Raceball. But first, stories about competitive cyclists getting injected or injecting themselves with various substances are myriad. Those stories don't have happy endings. But when have you heard about a whole team of competitive cyclists defined positively in part by virtue of the injecting they do? Phil Sutherland, the co-founder of Team Type 1, is here to tell you that story. Phil, welcome to Only a Game.
Hey, thanks for having us.
You were diagnosed with diabetes when you were only 7 months old, as I understand it. What prognosis did the doctors who diagnosed you give to your parents at that time?
You know, they essentially told my mom, you know, after I'd lost 10 pounds in 2 days, been misdiagnosed twice, they finally came in and said, we have good news and we have bad news. Good news is your son's going to live for now. Bad news is he's got juvenile diabetes. Based on current standards of care, treatment, and technology, if he lives to 25, which probably won't happen, he'll either have renal failure or be blind.
And how old are you now?
Well, I look 16, but I'm actually now 29. And at 25 years of age, myself and 7 other type 1 diabetics set a world record in a bike race across America. So to the doctor, how about them apples?
Yeah, so thumb your nose at the MDs on that one.
Exactly.
When did you decide to take up competitive cycling?
I started riding a bike when I was 12 years old, did my first race at 13, and it was, for me, the first time I was normal, because when you're riding bikes, everyone has to worry about blood sugar. Everyone has to fuel the body. And you know, it was a way to get away from my mom nagging me on, what's your blood sugar? Did you do your insulin? What'd you eat? It was a way to be free. You know, riding turned into racing and got to the point where I was actually pretty damn good on the bicycle. And I started winning a lot of races. One of them was the SEC Criterium Championships when I was racing for the University of Georgia. A guy came up to me and said, hey, I see you're checking your blood sugar. Do you have diabetes? And I said, nah, that's a bad habit I picked up freshman year in college. And we hit it off. Just so happened that guy also had diabetes. However, you know, for me, control was something I took pride in. I live every day to make sure I don't go blind from diabetes, and I work very hard at that. My buddy Joe, though, he wasn't taking that control, and he didn't really care, and which is, it's easy in a disease like diabetes, which it's 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, every day that you're alive. We started placing some bets to where the higher blood sugar paid for dinner. Joe paid for all my meals for a while. And then, he finally took control. And for me, that was a light switch in my life that, you know, helping people actually feels really good.
Are there a lot of potentially competitive cyclists lining up to join Team Type 1?
Yeah, there's, I get emails every day. I remember in 2005 when I was putting the team together for the Race Across America, it was a struggle to find 7 other athletes with diabetes who could compete. Over the last 6 years now, Team Type 1's grown to an organization of 136 people. I've got 60 Type 1 diabetics and a waiting list of about 50 athletes from countries all over the world who want to be a part of our racing team. There's 12-year-olds who say, I'm going to race on your team in the Tour de France one day.
And this has been successful. I mean, you guys aren't just out there to publicize the good works. You guys win.
Yeah, we're not here to show that, you know, you can go ride a bike with diabetes. We're here to show that if you take control, if you check your blood sugar, if you manage this disease, there's no dream that's too big. And we're racing in Italy today in the Strada Bianchi race, which is a classic race in Italian cycling, European cycling. We're also doing a Criterium in Singapore. I think I've got about 50 athletes who are doing their first races of their season all across the United States here.
I've read that at races in South Africa and Italy, as well as here in the U.S., fans have been especially supportive of your team. How has that support manifested itself as you've raced along?
You know, the support's been phenomenal. But what it's really allowed us to do is to make more of a difference in the communities. I brought 6 type 1 diabetics to do the Tour of Rwanda. Every child dies of diabetes, you know, but for us to come there and, you know, show them that, hey, with good control, you can live, we put a piece of hope in their lives that they never had before. And on top of that, we brought, you know, diabetes supplies for them, and we're now working on a 3-year program so that we can, you know, sustain the program and then scale the program so that every child in the world has access to medicine.
Tell me a little more about your plans going forward, both in terms of where you will next race and in terms of what Team Type 1 is going to be trying to accomplish.
So the goal for Team Type 1 since 2007 has been to put a Type 1 diabetic in the Tour de France by 2012. You know, we're on track to do that. We're doing major races all around the world. Our biggest race here in the U.S. will be the Amgen Tour of California this May. I want my team to win that. We took the King of the Mountains jersey last year, which was a great, great honor, but now we want to win. At the same time, we've launched a diabetes sports research platform to try and figure out how do we optimize blood glucose, you know, for performance.
Phil, you've talked a lot about control and taking control of your own life. But are there problems that you've had, physical problems that have come up as a result of your diabetes?
Yeah. I mean, when I was growing up, you know, I'd get the flu every year, and that would mean a trip to the hospital. You know, there were times where I had seizures, and you know, I went to sleep in my bed. I woke up in a hospital. There were lessons that I learned. Diabetes is not easy. Most insurance companies only pay for 6 test strips a day. Well, guess what, insurance? If I don't check 20 times a day, I don't control this disease. If I don't control this disease, I can't live a full life with diabetes. The thing I get the most is parents telling me they can't afford test strips for their children. Hmm. Their insurance company won't pay for it. I live a good life because I check my blood sugar. I live a good life because I give insulin. I live a good life because I take control of my diabetes. But I don't care if I have to call 7 times to the company and say, if you don't pay for my test strips, I'm just not going to check at all, and they're going to pay for my hospital visit. You know, you got to get pushy with these people. And I say we're doing all this work around the world, but you know, our big focus is here in the U.S., and we want to help make sure that everyone in the U.S. has everything they need to take control as well.
Phil Sutherland is the co-founder of Team Type 1, which now includes a women's professional team and an elite amateur team, among other aggregations. Phil, thank you very much for coming in to speak with me.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure. Thank you.
In his most recent book, titled Raceball, University of Pittsburgh historian Rob Ruck contends that what he calls, quote, the globalization of the sport, once known as the American pastime, quote, has come at the expense of baseball beyond U.S. borders. He also maintains that Major League Baseball has neglected the potential of African American athletes in the U.S. in favor of colonizing the regions that have produced many of today's best players, often to the detriment of everybody involved except the big league clubs and a small number of talented and fortunate players. Rob Ruck joins me now from WDUQ in Pittsburgh. Welcome to Only a Game.
Thanks, Bill.
You preface your argument with lots of baseball history, and I think one particular point you make is likely to surprise even serious baseball fans who've always thought the U.S. Marines, Army, and Navy were solely responsible for the popularity of baseball in Latin America. You regard that theory as incomplete at best.
Well, I think that folks from the United States did introduce baseball in parts of Mexico. And I did used to think that the Marines had infected the region with baseball fever during their occupations early last century. But what I found was that the game began in Cuba very soon after it began in the United States, brought back to Cuba in the 1860s, by boys who had studied in the United States and brought back the game as part of their cultural baggage. There was a wise old gentleman in Santo Domingo, Pedro Julio Santana, who told me a number of years ago, as we stood looking out of his window at the first Catholic cathedral in the Americas where Columbus was reputedly buried, and he said that the North Americans can be thought of as the Jesus Christ of baseball, but the Cubans were the apostles who took the game and spread it out into the Caribbean.
Is it fair to say that the regional policies of professional baseball regarding Latin America have resembled the politics of the U.S. toward Latin America in general?
Well, they've been pretty one-sided. Historically, Major League Baseball has seen the Caribbean as a source of cheap talent, and they've signed hundreds of kids for a couple of $1,000 in signing bonuses, hoping that one or two out of every 100 would succeed, getting guys like Pedro Martinez, Sammy Sosa, for a few $1,000 in signing bonuses. In more recent years, each major league club has established a year-round baseball academy in the Dominican Republic, several in Venezuela, where they train well over 1,000 kids in the Dominican alone. Those kids are an economic bargain for major league teams.
you research the numbers of major league players from various backgrounds in various decades, at least the last three or four decades. Tell us about the trends those numbers demonstrate regarding African-American players and Latin American players.
The integration of baseball in 1947 brought the greatest wave of talent into the game that it had ever seen. And by 1975, African Americans make up about 27% of all Major League Baseball players. At that time, the number of Latins is in single-digit percentages.
Mm-hmm.
But since 1975, about two-thirds of all the black players in the majors have left the game, and they're down to about 8 or 9% today. While the number of Latins in baseball has continued to rise, Latins in the majors make up close to 30% of all players and almost half of all those in the minors. And we are really talking about the best players in the game today.
Can the relative decrease in African-American major leaguers be explained by the increase in opportunities in pro basketball and pro football and the fact that a lot of great young African-American athletes in this country and a lot of African-American fans as well just prefer basketball and football to baseball?
Sure. And I think that the opening of colleges and universities, particularly in the North in the 1950s and 60s, to black athletes to play basketball and football was a turning point. But I think that even before that happened, the integration of Major League Baseball crushed the Negro Leagues, as well as the black sandlot infrastructure. The Negro Leagues and the black sandlots were how a young black kid learned how to play baseball. And after integration, when that infrastructure disappeared, the only way for a black kid to learn how to play baseball was either in college or in the minors, and neither were particularly hospitable to black athletes for different reasons.
You write about the Buscones, the scouts who look for talent in the Dominican Republic and Venezuela and various other places. They used to be called bird dogs in this country back when they were scouts before the Major League Scouting Bureau. Make the case for and against the Buscones.
The Buscones take advantage of two Major League Baseball policies. First, only kids from Canada, Puerto Rico, and the United States are subject to the annual baseball draft. That means that kids elsewhere in the world begin their careers as free agents. Secondly, Major League Baseball a couple of years ago, after being terribly embarrassed when the Blue Jays signed a 13-year-old Dominican to a contract, have set an age minimum. They will not sign kids until the summer they turn 17. A Buscone is somebody who will take a boy into his home or put him up in a pension, care for him, give him medical care, train him in how to play the game, and create a market for his services. Now, some of these guys are ethical, the best thing that ever happens to a boy. Others steal from the kid. And of course, the Buscone, when the boy signs, might get 30% of his signing bonus and salary. Some will encourage the boy to take vitamins, which turn out to be veterinary steroids.
Most corporations tend to look for the cheapest labor they can find, and certainly Latino players who aren't subject to Major League Baseball's draft and the salary scale that has resulted from the draft are less expensive to sign than players in the U.S. One MLB executive told you he could sign 12 excellent Latino players for the price of one top African-American prospect. Is it fair to say that Major League Baseball is just doing what any corporation does?
I guess the question is, do we have any ethical expectations for businesses? Are we going to accept savage capitalism, or do we want a more humane, democratic kind of capitalism? I know there aren't a lot of good alternatives for these kids in the first place, but I think that Major League Baseball, which is probably doing better as a business now than it ever has, can certainly redistribute a little bit of that wealth to ensure that these boys and those communities are getting a little more from their contribution to the game.
I'm speaking with Rob Ruck, the author of Raceball, and you're listening to Only a Game. Rob, you write about the determination of former Major League stars like Juan Marichal, Felipe Alou, and Manuel Mota to, quote, restore the integrity of baseball in the Dominican Republic. How do you define that task of restoration?
I think it's a wild west right now, where you've got a lot of unscrupulous people taking advantage of kids in terms of drugs and fraud regarding ages and in signing contracts. Now, Major League Baseball about a year ago sent Sandy Alderson down there to become the new sheriff and clean things up. And he was talking about creating Major League Baseball organized youth leagues, fingerprinting and blood testing kids to verify identity and whether or not they were using drugs. And I think MLB would like to expand the draft to the Dominican. It's a little pushy for MLB to come in and try to tell Dominicans what to do. I think that Dominicans need to take ownership of these issues.
What about the efforts of Major League Baseball to develop African-American players through the program called RBI, Reviving Baseball in the Inner Cities? Is that program succeeding?
Well, RBI was a program started in 1988 by John Young, who had played Major League Ball from Compton, L.A., who looked around and saw that his community was no longer producing ballplayers. RBI has produced 200,000-plus kids who've gone through that program, and they get education as well as learn how to play baseball. 2 years ago, 2009 World Series began with C.C. Sabathia on the mound throwing the ball to Jimmy Rollins, only the second time in baseball history that the series began with a black man throwing to a black man. Both Sabathia and Rollins came through RBI. MLB has begun to sponsor it. They've committed to building 10 baseball academies in cities with major league teams. But I don't think there's any expectation that baseball will ever become what it once was. I think that Major League Baseball has been embarrassed by the decline of black players. I think they've also been hurt at the gate by not having that many black fans anymore. I mean, you go to a ball game and black faces are usually pretty hard to find. Which is a far cry from 1947 when the Brooklyn Dodgers set attendance records at home and on the road because of black fans.
Rob Ruck is the author of Raceball, How the Major Leagues Colonized the Black and Latin Game. The book is published by Beacon Press, and Rob Ruck joined me from WDUQ in Pittsburgh. Rob, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Well, thanks, Bill. I really appreciate it.
It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced, Harvard University, whose summer school has courses for high school, college, and adults to earn academic credit and experience campus life, summer.harvard.edu, and Oliver Wyman, an international strategy consulting firm. With 3,000 professionals worldwide, Oliver Wyman serves global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com. This is NPR.
4.1 ounces may not sound very heavy, but when you get an egg that weighs that much, you get yourself a fair-sized breakfast. The average egg in your refrigerator weighs about 2 ounces, which is why Mr. Nathan Batten of Bonaparte, Iowa, was amazed when one of his Australoop hens delivered the prize, which measures 3.5 inches long and 6.5 inches around. Mr. Batten intends to show the egg to a representative from Guinness World Records, but he was so proud of it that for several days after it appeared, he carried it around in his pocket so he could show it to friends. When some of those friends pretended they weren't impressed, Mr. Batten tossed the egg over his shoulder and caught it behind his back. I made that part up.
Now she wants a buttering egg man. A big, big buttering egg man from way down south.
I'm Bill Littlefield, coming up on Only a Game, beach volleyball, when and where it's needed most. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for our look at the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill.
After an extension led to a second extension, the NFL and its Players Association now have at least a little more time to reach an agreement. Is there any hope that the next 6 days will lead to anything more promising than yet another extension?
Well, no, because I think the owners want this lockout, and I think there are enough of the owners who are willing to stand firm in order for management to get the lockout they want. I was a little bit encouraged by the ruling by the federal judge that the NFL had acted in bad faith and they couldn't use the TV money they had promised to the players to fund their lockout emergency fund. But I still think they want a lockout, and I think that's what they're going to get.
The contracts of pro football players, like the contracts of lots of pro athletes, often feature incentive clauses. Vernon Golston, until recently a defensive end with the New York Jets, had one of those in his contract. Did the clause do him any good?
There's a great old Saturday Night Live skit about Celebrity Jeopardy, where Alex Trebek finally gives up on Sean Connery and the rest of them and says, just write anything. All Vernon Golston had to do to earn $9 million was record a sack or force a fumble or recover a fumble.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't do it.
$9 million.
I would have offered an opposing quarterback $1 million to let me sack him.
Meanwhile,
fall down.
The student newspaper at the University of Connecticut reported this week that UConn spent $1.8 million more than they earned for playing in the Fiesta Bowl. I thought football was supposed to be one of the revenue sports, meaning revenue in rather than revenue out.
Well, remarkably, the University of Connecticut, in its first try at a major BCS bowl game, only sold 2,700 tickets out of 17,500 tickets, which means the university had to absorb the cost of the remaining 14,729 tickets, and that bill came to somewhere close to $3 million. So here's the deal. If you don't want to lose money on your bowl appearance, make people go. Require that your students get on an airplane. Hire the plane. Ask Vernon Golston. He would have had the money.
The University of Oregon's recruiting policies are being questioned, Charlie. The Ducks apparently paid much more than the listed price for recruiting video services to a guy who just happened to be mentoring one of their recruits and traveling with another of their recruits. I can't imagine there's anything not on the up and up here.
Yeah, old Will Lyles. What could possibly go wrong? Especially considering he's described in the story about it as a, quote, speed coach turned recruiting services proprietor.
Mm-hmm.
If anybody knows what either one of those job description is, please get in touch with us. Basically, it's a long way of saying bag man.
This week, Sports Illustrated and CBS News published the results of an investigation that found that 7% of recruited football players at the top 25 football powerhouses had criminal records, and the investigation also demonstrated that only 2 of those 25 schools had done any background checks on the people they were recruiting. Should they have done such checks?
First of all, I think that considering they're including things like DUI and you know, minor drug offenses, I'm surprised that the percentages aren't higher than 7%. I think if I were running a high-profile college sports program, I would want to know it, whether or not I was recruiting people with criminal records. But then again, you can run into all kinds of problems. I mean, there are states where you're not allowed to look at juvenile criminal records, and certainly nobody's going to expect the schools to go to court to open up, you know, juvenile criminal records.
The NBA held its first regular season game in London's O2 Arena last night, Charlie, and now British papers are declaring that London will have a team of its own within the next 10 years. So what do you think? Possibility of regular road trips across the Atlantic Ocean for NBA teams?
I think they should just move the Clippers there, because clearly it's never going to happen for them in Los Angeles.
On Wednesday night, Brigham Young University, late the number 3 men's basketball team in the land, lost to New Mexico by 18 points. That loss was in part attributable to the absence of Brandon Davies. Is it fair to say that Mr. Davies was dismissed by BYU for a reason that nobody would have cared about or even noticed if he'd played anywhere else?
Yes, because Brigham Young has an honor code which requires that you not have premarital sex with anyone. And either Mr. Davies gave himself up or he was finked on, which leads me to believe that the Brigham Young campus and what used to be East Germany have a lot more in common than I thought they did. Brigham Young is being praised for standing by its principles, which I have a feeling is probably the reason why this happened in the first place. But it is remarkable, and it pretty much guarantees that very few players are going to go to Brigham Young who are not of the Mormon faith.
All right, there's a new record for the longest game in college hockey history, Charlie. Wednesday night's game between the women's teams at Queen's University and the University of Guelph ended 2-1 in Queen's favor after the 6th, count 'em, 6th extra period. You usually yell sports when I mention a new world record, but I assume that this is one that's worthy of a tip of the cap.
Yeah, this is the real thing, Bill. I mean, they played a 10-minute overtime and then 4 20-minute overtimes before Morgan Mahaffey, remember that game to win free beers at your local? Well, somebody asked you who scored the game-winning goal in the longest hockey game ever. And I feel sort of bad for Guelph, actually, because it's a shame, Bill, when either team has to lose one of these. But the spectators are probably pretty happy that someone did.
I would think by the time the game ended, most of the spectators were asleep or they'd gone home. I don't know which. In Major League Baseball / financial news, is it accurate to say that Red Sox owner John Henry has learned that free speech can cost as much as $500,000 a paragraph?
$500,000, because John Henry pointed out that a lot of his quote-unquote small market unquote brethren are just pocketing the revenue sharing money and not plowing it back into the baseball product.
All right, let's get to some on-the-field baseball news. Spring training is, of course, in full swing, and it looks as if the Chicago Cubs are in mid-season form.
Well, this isn't quite on the field. It's in the dugout. It's closer to the
it's
field.
Right next
it's
to the
closer
field.
To the field than we used to be. Yeah, they're slugging each other, Bill. Carlos Silva, one of the pitchers, and Aramis Ramirez, the third baseman, got in a punch-up in the dugout, and Silva was upset because he gave up 6 runs in the first inning, including 3 unearned because of errors. And apparently Silva came back in and started screaming about the defense. And Ramirez, who made one of the errors, took exception to that. And off we go for another wonderful season of Cubs baseball.
Finally, we come to the matter of David Beckham's most recent tattoo.
Oh, we do? Okay.
In which he apparently represents himself as Jesus. Look, long ago, a sports editor warned his writers against, quote, godding up the athletes. But what are we to do when the athlete gods up himself?
Stop godding up your pecs, Bex, basically. Yeah, he's got quite a half-nude dude there representing Jesus, who's really kind of cut and much more than you would expect from a first-century Jewish carpenter. But he's also being attended to by cherubs who allegedly represent the younger Becks.
This is what David Beckham says. These are my sons.
At least he didn't call them his only begotten sons,
no.
But I'm sure he'll get there. But remember, of course, that these are also the children of Posh Spice. Make of that what you will, Dan Brown. Mary Magdalene, me no Mary Magdalene.
You know, he'll probably take you up on the challenge. Charlie Pierce is the author of Idiot America, among other books, and he joins me each week on Only a Game as well. Thanks, Charlie.
Just pay the guy $1 million.
Anyone who's been paying attention to this program knows that college sports are big business, except when they aren't. From Ringe, New Hampshire, Only a Game's Karen Given has this story.
It's the last Friday in February, and it's been snowing all day long. The roads are covered with a sheet of ice. Tonight's low, 9 degrees plus wind chill. But inside the bubble at Franklin Pierce University, it's a beach party. The bubble is Franklin Pierce's indoor practice facility, officially called the Grimshaw Gudowitz Activity Center. Jean St. Pierre introduces himself as the bubble guy and proudly surveys his handiwork, a beach volleyball pit, a 2-story tall volcano made of chicken wire and tissue paper, and a golf cart dressed up to look like a fishing boat.
Well, you want to make it look realistic. After all, this is college now, right? They're supposed to be stepping it up a notch, right? You don't just put some paper mache on the side of your car and some soap anymore, you know? You actually frame up your car and make it look like a ship going down the road.
One night a year, as the winter doldrums set in on campus, the bubble is transformed. A few years ago, Gene took advantage of the 72-foot-high ceilings to install a scale model of Fenway Park, complete with a 16-foot-high green monster so that students could challenge each other to an all-night wiffle ball tournament.
And in those days, it used to be 8-8 all night. That's why it's called up all night. But the kids kind of faded out by 2 or 3, so now we really don't.
No sense in making the adults stay up that late if the kids are...
I was the only one. I'd be here at 8 o'clock saying, it's time for breakfast, you guys. Wake up.
These days, the event ends at 2 a.m., when some of the students will head to other, less wholesome parties. Doug Carty is the director of campus recreation.
For the short hour, 2 hours, 3 hours they spend here, I think they enjoy themselves, and it certainly keeps them preoccupied and hopefully re-energizes them a little more as the spring comes in.
The weather was so bad today that all classes after 2 p.m. were canceled. There's a rumor going around that the campus shuttle slid into a car to avoid sliding into the admissions office. Either way, students had to find their own way to the bubble during the night. But Carty says canceling up all night was never an option.
We already had the sand in the bubble for the beach volleyball. To postpone it a week, that means another week of trying to keep the sand in that contained area. We already had the volcano built, and that meant we would have had to remove it and put it somewhere else. So weather be damned, we're here.
This year, Cardi's little slice of sunshine is a regulation-sized beach volleyball pit where a basketball court normally resides. Workers brought in a couple tons of sand by the wheelbarrow load and painstakingly layered it until it was more than a foot deep. Cardi was worried the sand would be cold. After all, it was brought in from across campus, not from Florida or California. But seniors Steve Richards and Jared Gardner, who recently returned from a semester abroad, majoring in beach volleyball at a university in Australia, say the temperature is fine.
It's not chilly, it's a little rocky, but it's not bad for New Hampshire. You know, you expect it. It's the Granite State. There's got to be some stuff in the sand.
There's some granite in there.
Okay.
So we've got two more teams waiting to play, and then we'll get you guys on after, okay?
Okay.
As the competition gets underway, teams of four line up to join in. Senior Rob Harpin's team was one of the first to give it a try. Harpin says he lives for beach volleyball.
We have an outdoor court here, too. So we play beach in the fall and the spring, which is about a month each time, you know? Doesn't last very long.
Doesn't last long at all.
Yeah, so we get out there every day we can.
Harpin's friends were so excited about the chance to play in the middle of winter that they helped set up the bubble for tonight's festivities. For their efforts, they received matching up-all-night staff T-shirts, bright green with a graphic of a coconut bra and a belly button. They've accessorized the shirts with matching trucker hats, making them the only beach volleyball team in uniform. Not everyone is impressed.
They win at every intramural volleyball game, and they kind of live for it, and we just want to play and have fun and beat them.
Yeah! Woo!
Sam, Lauren, Nicole, and Saskia have entered the tournament with one goal and one goal only, to beat the guys in trucker hats. But it would defeat the purpose to take that goal too seriously.
It's just fun. It's just to get out and you see everyone. You get to do things you did when you were a kid, like bouncy slides and just have fun. Yeah, you're not stuck inside in the freezing cold doing nothing. You get to come here and pretend like it's a beach.
The university hopes this event will encourage students to spend at least one cold winter's night doing something other than drinking in their dorm rooms. But juniors John Sinsali and Vincent Roberts seem like they might not have gotten that memo. John is hiding his eyes behind a Tom Cruise-style pair of sunglasses, and Vincent is pretending to be Russian.
It smells like feet and a little bit of BO, you know, but it's all good. It's fine. I have my shades on because it's a beach, you know, paradise type of deal.
His eyes are very sensitive to the light.
You're wearing shades and flannel.
Yes.
These people are wearing shorts. You didn't quite embrace the whole theme.
Well, it's snowing outside, so what can you expect?
It is snowing. He's right, you know.
As the clock winds its way past midnight, the line for the mechanical shark gets shorter and shorter. Those taking advantage of the bungee bounce start to get dizzy from all that spinning. And the guys in the trucker hats are still lurking on the sidelines of the volleyball pit, waiting for the inevitable.
It's really not a tournament anymore because it's just a matter of time before we win.
Justin Weiner isn't worried that entire teams have formed with the goal of stopping him. In fact, there seems to be only one thing that worries Justin Weiner.
I hate losing. I really do. It bugs me. I don't sleep at night.
All that not sleeping at night comes in handy when playing in the final of a beach volleyball tournament at 1 in the morning. The referee's eyes might be getting tired, but Weiner's tongue is still sharp.
He hit. Point over here.
What? Yep. Are you kidding me?
I saw the whole thing. When
in the final match, the guys in trucker hats are facing a team led by none other than recreation director Doug Cardi. Cardi and his team keep the score close, but they're just no match for the perennial intramural champs. By the time the whole thing's over, the only cheering comes from a couple of girls who aren't even sure who won.
Well, that's what happens at 1 o'clock in the morning. I think everyone's like, okay.
Nobody's happy to win or sad to lose.
They're happy.
It's over.
Well, the first thing he says is, where's my T-shirt? I'm like, all right, that's what they get. So
all of that for a T-shirt.
Yeah, I know.
The cheering section begs for T-shirts of their own, but Doug Carty's too tired to entertain their pleas. After all, it's nearly two, and he still has to dismantle that volcano, send away the mechanical shark in the laser tag center, and get the bubble ready for intramural sports to start again in the morning.
Everyone likes the coconut bra T-shirts that we made for the event, but they're for our volunteers.
What if they were to, like, take all this sand out of here for you? Would you give them the T-shirt
I would give
then?
Them the T-shirt. I would. And some sand. And some sand. I would.
For Only a Game, I'm Karen Given.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Trabu. Our technical director is John Perotti. Our intern is Mark Filippino, and we had help this week from Jeremy Bernfeld. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To view Karen's beach volleyball photo gallery, subscribe to the Only a Game podcast, listen to archived shows and stories, and learn more about our weekly music selections, please visit our website, onlyagame.org. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Only a Game Radio. Our final word comes from Jean St. Pierre, who discusses the real purpose of having a volcano on the Franklin Pierce campus.
We're actually going to sacrifice one of our employees later. You want to be around. He doesn't know he's going in.
Huh. How come we don't have one of those? I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at mecfound.org. The Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, committed to helping Americans lead healthier lives and get the care they need, on the web at rwjf.org. And the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, making grants to solve social and environmental problems at home and around the world, on the web at hewlett.org. This is NPR.